All right, we're going to be doing a bunch of jumping around here tonight. We're starting our series on the life of Solomon. And I wanted to give you some background on the situation as far as when Solomon came to the throne. We're going to start out with the land. I like that. That's a good picture, Aaron. You did a good job. Okay, here's our map of what Israel looked like. This is the extent of the kingdom. And this would be during the time of the judges and so forth. Now, during the reign of Saul, who was David's predecessor, Solomon was the third king to rule over Israel. Prior to that, you had the judges for around 350 years or so. And they were in part in succession, but some of them overlap. You had judges that may have been over here in Gilead, and others down here in on the south side or on the west side, others that were here in the north, and some of them at the same time. There was a lot of overlap, especially later on. The earlier judges, less so. But when they were all done, this was about the amount of real estate that Israel controlled. This is not too different from what it was following the conquest under Joshua. However, during the time of Joshua, the valley here, this is the Valley of Megiddo or the Esdraelon Valley. It's got several different names, Valley of Jezreel. This area here was still dominated by the Canaanites during part of the time of Judges. And then so was the valley region here. The lowlands and so on were dominated still by the Canaanites for a long time because they had the chariots of iron. And then the Philistines are here in the southwest. And during the time of Saul, toward the end of Saul's reign, the Philistines had the preeminence, and they ended up controlling the whole west coast area here of Israel by the time Saul was done. As a matter of fact, Saul died way up here. The Philistines had come up all the way into this area, and Israel moved its capital to Mahanaim. This is where Saul's son, Ishbosheth, ruled from Mahanaim, east of Jordan, because of the threat of the Philistines. This would be the situation that David came into after Saul's death, and David defeated the Philistines. He took the Philistines and defeated them over and over again and drove them back down into their five cities down here. This is part of which makes up the Gaza Strip today. Ancient Philistia was a little bit bigger, went up the coast a little bit further than the modern Gaza Strip. Gaza, of course, being one of the original Philistine cities. So this is what David would have inherited. By the time David ruled for a total of 40 years. He ruled from the city of Hebron, way down here, for 7 years, and then ruled from Jerusalem, which is right here on the Judah-Benjamin border, ruled from Jerusalem for the balance of his reign, and he died there in Jerusalem. David defeated in battle those around him. Most of the wars were those that were defensive originally. It's kind of like how Israel fights its wars today. They're attacked, and they beat their attacker and keep expanding their territory. And, of course, you've heard lots of talk. We have the Philistines. I've already pointed those out. The Ammonites were here to the east on the edge of the desert. That city of Rabbah Ammon is today the capital of the country of Jordan. It's called Ammon today after the Ammonites. To the south, still in the modern country of Jordan, was the Moabites on the east side of the Dead Sea. And then south, and actually a little bit east of the Dead Sea, was the country of Edom. These were long-term enemies of Israel, even though God had told Moses, do not invade them, do not molest them, do not invade their territory. I have given their pieces of real estate, their land to them. That is not for Israel. And yet, in spite of that, they were a constant thorn in the flesh to the Israelites during frankly, almost all of their history. David defeated these folks, and when he was done, David had built an empire. Now, what was the red part there is the part that Israel had when Saul died. That's what David inherited. But all that blue and further up into the green, that is the empire that David built. And by the time David died, he had subjugated all of his enemies. The people to the along the coast there, these people here, this is the Phoenicians. And they were the ones that supplied David with his cedar lumber. The cedar of Lebanon grows in the, or used to, there's still just a few of them left, but in the mountains along here, this is where the cedars grew. Great big huge trees. There were nothing like that in Israel, and so if you wanted large timber for building material, you had to get it from them. And they would bring it down. The coastline here is narrow. It's right close to the mountains. They would bring the logs down here into floats and bring them down to Joppa. And then they would bring them up to Jerusalem or wherever they were going, but usually Jerusalem from there. That would be what the palaces were built out of in part. That would be what the temple was built out of in part. So David built this gigantic empire. Now, with David's rule also, the people were not worshiping Baal. They were worshiping the Lord God. And the tabernacle that Moses had built in the wilderness was in Gibeah, which is a little bit north of Jerusalem. And it was still a tent. It had been in at least three or four different locations since the time that Joshua had brought the children of Israel into the land. It had been burned and destroyed once by the Philistines and rebuilt. But that was the place of worship. And as a result of that also, the people were worshiping the Lord in some of the high places. And it talks about the problem of that because God had said there would be one place of worship. So the people were illegitimately worshiping the true God very often during the time of the judges and other times, and in part during the time of David, the Lord. He focused on that one tabernacle. Now, here's the problem that also that David inherited when he came to the throne. The Ark of the Covenant was not in the tabernacle. Way back in the beginnings of 1 Samuel, remember they had taken it out as sort of a good luck charm to take to battle against the Philistines? And they lost anyway. And the Philistines had captured the Ark of the Covenant. It was in the land of the Philistines for some months and finally sent back to Israel. But it didn't go back to the tabernacle. And Saul came to the throne, and it still was not put back in the tabernacle during the entire reign of Saul, and he ruled for 40 years. And so the worship of the Lord was not in accord with what God had given at Mount Sinai. But David, after he had captured Jerusalem, brought the Ark of the Covenant into Jerusalem. Now remember, the tabernacle is still at Gibeon. But he pitched a tent for it there, and he had an altar in front of that tent. And so there were two places of worship during the reign of David. One there at Jerusalem, before the Ark of the Covenant there in the tent, and then the other one at Gibeon. That's why during the reign of David, there were two high priests. You had Abiathar and Zadok. One was, and they were both legitimate. But there was two high priests during the reign of David because they had two central places of worship. It wasn't until Solomon that they brought the Ark of the Covenant into the temple that he would build, and from there on out, you had one place of worship. At least legitimately, there was some other things going on as well. So this is what Solomon inherited from David. The culture was worshiping the Lord. They were not pursuing the false gods. Baal worship was not a major problem during the reign of David. It frankly had not been a big problem during the reign of Saul either, although he had his other problems. Enemies around them had either been conquered, or a few of them that had traditionally been enemies had become allies. They had just said, oh, well, Israel's much, much stronger than we are, and so we'll chum up with them a little bit. And the Philistines were actually, to some extent, David's allies. At least one of the generals in his army was a Philistine. Remember, David had spent some time down among the Philistines and had developed some relationships there. The Phoenicians up there on the coast were commercial allies and therefore were in good relations with them. And then Solomon, when he was a very young man, married the daughter of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And so they were allies with the Egyptians. The folks way up to the north and to the further to the east, the Assyrians and the Babylonians and so on, were not a problem at this time. They were not terribly powerful at this point. And so that empire was secure. Solomon's name is derived from the same word that we get our word shalom from, which means, help me out, what's shalom mean? Peace. And so when David died, he gave Solomon this vast empire that we dealt with the subjugated enemies. We dealt with the people worshiping the Lord. We dealt with this vast expanse of territory that he had inherited. And not only that, when David went to war, when he defeated his enemies, this was, by the way, what people did following a war, even as recently as on a large scale, World War I and even beyond. If you lost, you paid reparations. And not only that, if you lost, the people who were the conquerors would loot and pillage those who were defeated. And so David, in his conquering all that area in blue, was paid tribute and was given all this stuff. He gained all kinds of iron and bronze and silver and gold and precious stones. And, you know, it's kind of interesting. If I'm worth, let's say for the sake of argument, I'm worth $100 million. That's a lot of money. Think about $100 million. I could go out, if I've got it in an annuity or something like that, and I'm generating income from this, you know, I could probably run out and buy whatever I wanted to buy. And after I've bought everything I've wanted to get, and gone and seen everything that I've wanted to see, and done all I want to do, I would still have lots and lots and lots of money. We're going to come back into that whole concept when we get into Ecclesiastes here in a few weeks. So what do you do then? Well, what do people in America do when they have reached that point where they have done all they wanted to do and bought all they wanted to buy? What do they start to do? They start to meddle in other people's affairs. All right? So they throw all their efforts in something, into some cause. Okay? You get the Hollywood crowd that does that when they get to their older years. So when they get behind something. Maybe it may be totally wacky, but they're going to get behind it because it's important to them, because I've got to get into something that's bigger and better than just me. Or I get involved in politics. And politics can be got into for two reasons. One, I just want the power for the sake of power so I can tell people what to do. Or, getting back to the idea of a cause, if I'm actually going to have some power and some basis to be able to implement what I think is that great cause, political office will give me that means to be able to do that. And so very often people will do, that's what they do in our country, and that's what they do in a lot of the societies where you have open elections and so on, that people will get into office to accomplish something. And sometimes it's a good thing. Abraham Lincoln pursued politics in large part so he could end slavery. That was his goal. Some people do it for noble causes and noble purposes. The problem is that very often when people get into power for the right reasons, the longer they're there, the more it becomes, I'm here for the power. All right. Now, Solomon has all this wealth. David accumulated all this wealth. David had a palace. David's a king. He doesn't have anybody. He doesn't have any red tape to go through. There's no bureaucracy. He says, I want this done. And they all bow and prostrate themselves on the ground and run off and do what he told them to do, because he's king. It's kind of a good deal if you happen to be the king. The problem is, once you have reached this point, there's no more lands to conquer, realistically. I mean, I can keep going and going and going, but when it comes to transportation in the day, I mean, it'd take me, you know, 3 weeks to get to wherever I'm wanting to go. These days, you know, you jump on an airplane, you're there. But you got this huge piece of real estate. My people are prospering. My people are serving the Lord. And I have more money than I know what to do with. What do I do? And I have a heart to serve God. I want to serve God. Now, going back to what I told you a little bit ago, the Ark of the Covenant is in Jerusalem. The tabernacle is at Gibeon. And David, after he had reached this pinnacle of power and so on, said to Nathan, I dwell in a palace, but the Ark dwells under curtains. And Nathan said to David, go do all that is in thine heart, for God is with thee. And then God appeared to Nathan in a dream and said, no, it's not for David. David's been a man of war. He has shed a great deal of blood. It won't be for him. It'll be for his son. And so David gets the blueprints by revelation for the temple. He's got all the loot, all this money, all this gold, and he stockpiles, because he's got the blueprints, he knows exactly what he needs. He stockpiles all these gigantic, huge stone blocks. He stockpiles all this cedar timber. He stockpiles silver and gold and iron and bronze and everything that's possible. And not only that, when he's an old guy, knowing his time is short, he goes out and he lines up all the craftsmen, all the people that are the best at their job to do the work of building the temple. I've got it all lined up so that when I can die, I can hand the instructions to my son because God said he would do it. And I'm good to go. It's going to come after me, but I have the promise of God that it'll happen. But I'm going to do it. I can't build it myself. God has said so. But I'm going to come this close. I'm going to do everything I can short of building it. That is what Solomon inherited. When he came to the throne, he had peace, he had power, and he had provision. Let's alliterate it there. Peace, power, and provision. And a program. Let's throw in another one. That's for some people, that is like the ideal situation. But at the same time, they're coming with that is a huge amount of responsibility. Shortly after Solomon came to the throne, God appeared to him. He went to Gibeon and he performed, he had a whole bunch of sacrifices. And God appeared to him and said, ask what you will and I'll give it to you. Now, you tell me, what did Solomon ask for? He asked for wisdom. That I may know how to rule this great people. And God said, because you have not asked for the lives of your enemies, because you have not asked for wealth, you haven't asked for long life, good grief, what more could he get as far as wealth? God said, I will give you the other things as well, but I will give you wisdom. How old was Solomon when he came to the throne? Now, consider this. Solomon also was probably the least likely candidate to come to the throne. David had a bunch of other sons. As a matter of fact, some of Solomon's half-brothers were old enough to be his dad. Under normal circumstances, when a king died, who becomes the king in his place? Firstborn, the eldest son, the eldest surviving son. Going back into the book of 2 Samuel, the oldest son of David was a fellow named Amnon. Amnon is the one, you get into all the intrigue, after David committed adultery, all kinds of horrible things happened in his life. Everything was going great and then he commits adultery and then everything goes bad. Sin has a tendency to mess things up in our lives. There's always consequences. Amnon raped his half-sister Tamar. Her full brother, who was next in line, by the way, he's the second oldest surviving son of David, schemes and plots and waits 2 years to get his revenge. And after 2 years, everything seems to have calmed down. Absalom kills, or has his older brother killed, and then he flees to Geshur. Geshur was the home of Absalom's maternal grandfather. Geshur is a little teeny tiny kingdom here on the east side of the Sea of Galilee. It was at that time. And because of its alliance with David, it was technically a little independent kingdom. Even though it was surrounded by areas controlled by Israel. And so he was there for a couple of years so he could avoid the consequences of his murder, of his intrigue. But again, time has a tendency to heal some wounds. And Joab pulled some strings because he figured, hey, I need to stay on the good side of the fellow who's going to end up succeeding David. I need to make sure that I ingratiate myself to him. And so he pulls some strings and has Absalom come home. Absalom, after he's home for a while, 4 years, he plots and schemes. And then he tries to usurp the throne because he doesn't want to wait. And also, word had probably come down because God had revealed to David and to Nathan that it wasn't going to be the older boys that were going to become king. It was this young kid who was way down the totem pole, a guy named Solomon. Solomon was going to be king. And so the older brothers, recognizing that a great many of the people would expect them to be king, were going to try to make sure that they could become king. First, because Amnon's dead, Absalom tries. And we have the whole civil war that takes place in 2 Samuel, chapters 15 through 18. And we end up with a battle over here on the east side, over in the Gilead area. And that's where Absalom gets his lovely locks caught in the branches of a tree. And Joab, again, knowing which side of the bread is buttered, that guy, I tell you what, Joab is the most scheming guy I think that exists in the Old Testament. He was great at what he did, but my word, what a scheming guy. He bumps off Absalom. We're going to make sure that Absalom is dead. We're going to make sure this is all done. And politically, it was a smart, smart, smart move. Joab bumps off Absalom. The civil war is all over. And everybody goes back to Jerusalem. And we have peace and tranquility for a while. A decade or so goes by. And another son by the name of Adonijah. He's number three. He's the next one in line. Adonijah says, I will be king. And this is in 1 Kings chapter 1. And he has Joab on his side, and he sort of declares himself to be king. Now, David is still on the throne, but he's an old, old guy at this point. As old as maybe even some of you. And Nathan and Bathsheba get together, and they said, we've got to let David know about this, and we've got to figure out how we're going to make sure Solomon, whom God has appointed to be king, actually becomes king. And so they go to David, and you read this in First Kings chapter 1. They come in succession and say, David, oh, king, haven't you said that Solomon is going to be, and yet Adonijah rules. Don't you know this? And so David makes arrangements for Solomon to actually be crowned king. Adonijah flees for his life and grabs the horns of the altar, and Solomon has mercy on him, although that only lasts for one chapter because he tries another thing and ends up getting executed. But Solomon comes to the throne. Now, Solomon was not the youngest son of David, but one of the youngest sons of David. He was one of the four sons of Bathsheba. How old was Solomon when he came to the throne? Now, if you look at his son Rehoboam, Rehoboam was 41 when he came to the throne. Solomon ruled for 40 years. So Solomon had a son before he came to the throne, but he was an infant. Solomon was probably about 20 years old when he came to the throne. He was a young man. When David was giving a speech to the children of Israel after Solomon had come to the throne, he says, my son Solomon is young and inexperienced. He's but a child. He's young and inexperienced. And he was. 20-year-old kid coming to the throne. Now, he didn't have... Look at Saul. What did Saul do before he became king? What was his occupation? Was he a soldier? What was he? He was a farmer. Now, his dad was a mighty man of, by the way, the word mighty man in Hebrew can convey wealth as well as, you know, strength of arms. And evidently Saul's father was a well-to-do man, but Saul was a farmer. When, after he had been crowned king and the Ammonites invaded the land over in Gilead, what was Saul doing when news came of the invasion? He was plowing. He's the crowned king, but he's plowing. That's Saul's background. What was David before he became king? He's a shepherd. He's chasing sheep across the wilderness. What was Solomon before he became king? He was a prince that lived in the palace and had any and everything he could possibly imagine. He had the best of everything. And having come in late in David's reign, he was probably, David was probably in his mid to late 40s when Solomon was born. So David had already gotten over the hurdle of all of his battles and so on for the most part. All of his wars and so forth. And so the palace was there. Solomon grew up in the palace, but Solomon was also old enough to have been around and observe the rape of his half-sister and the murder of his oldest brother and the intrigue and death of his second oldest brother. He was around to observe those things and old enough to see what was going on and know what was going on, even though he was a child. He was almost certainly among the evacuees that fled Jerusalem when Absalom came to the throne for his brief rule. But he's a young man. He comes to the throne, he inherits all these things, the best of all situations, it would seem. Now, under letter B, we have the personalities. It's fascinating. You read the life of David, you've got all kinds of important personalities that are talked about at length. When you read about the life of Solomon, and you've got 10 or 11 chapters in 1 Kings dealing with the life of Solomon, as well as a few little bits and pieces you can pick up from 2 Samuel. And yet the focus is almost entirely on Solomon himself and what he did. It isn't so much on the people that were around him. But we're going to mention four people that will have some importance as far as the reign of Solomon is concerned. Number one is Benaiah the son of Jehoiada. Benaiah the son of Jehoiada. Say, who in the world is Benaiah the, how do you, whoever, what's his name? Benaiah the son of Jehoiada is the guy who replaced Joab. He's in charge of the army. By the way, he was also a priest. He was also one of David's mighty men, and he was head of David's personal bodyguard when he was alive. He becomes the head of the military under Solomon. We had two high priests under the reign of David. One of them was a fairly young man by the name of Zadok. Sounds like the name of a comic book character, Zadok. And what's interesting is when you see that name Zadok in your Old Testament, there's a number of guys named Zadok. They're almost always priests. What's interesting also about the line of Zadok is they were the high priests. He and his descendants were the high priests until the Israelites were carried away captive. And even they were high priests up until the time of the Maccabees. The priests under Zadok during the time of the kingdom, in spite of the fact that there were some really awful, wicked kings, some of them worshiped Baal, some of them burnt their own children in the fire to Moloch, performing child sacrifice. Some of the kings, the descendants of David, were awful. But as you read the prophets, one of the things that's very interesting is that the line of Zadok was always faithful. Up until the captivity, and even beyond to some extent, the line of Zadok was always faithful. Not all the priests were, but Zadok and his descendants were. You have Hiram of Tyre. Hiram of Tyre. Who in the world is Hiram of Tyre? Well, there were two Hirams, and they're actually connected to each other. One is the Hiram of Tyre, is the king of Tyre, but that's not the guy we're talking about here, even though he and Solomon were something of, they were economic allies. But this Hiram of Tyre was the craftsman that came from Tyre. Tyre's the Phoenician city. Tyre is right here on the coast of, let me get my thing here, is right here on the coast of what is now Lebanon, a little bit south of Beirut today. He was the guy that came from Lebanon and did all the fancy work for Solomon's temple. He's the guy that had the know-how. He's the guy who was the expert in working with bronze and in cutting fine stones and in working with timber. The guy was just an expert at all kinds of stuff. And so he was sent by the folks there in Tyre, by the king of Tyre, to supervise and do the fine work and so on for the construction of the temple. He was the superb craftsman that did all the fancy work and supervised the construction of the temple. And then later on, we'll see in the life of Solomon, we have the Queen of Sheba. The Queen of Sheba is important not because so much of who she is, but what she represents. Because what we have is you go through the, if picture in your mind the timeline of Israel. All right? We had the call of Abraham, and then we have this age of promise. Jacob and his sons and their sons and their sons go down into the land of Egypt when Joseph is prime minister. They are there for 430 years. They multiply. When they come out under Moses after they had been enslaved by the Egyptians, we're dealing with a nation of between 1.5 and 3 million people. And again, sit down with a calculator and it's very easy to take that many people and get to become this many people. And so they multiplied, so you have enough people to be a nation. But they had always been under the heel of the Egyptians, even though they had lived in a particular part of Egypt, so they maintained their language and to some extent their worship. But they received the law of Moses at Mount Sinai, and during the wilderness wanderings, they had, for the most part, their Egyptianism wrung out of them. And it took quite a while. But by the time we come to Joshua bringing the children of Israel into the land of Israel during the time of the conquest, they had set aside that because that first generation that came out of Egypt had died off. The people who came in were the people who had, for the most part, grown up in the wilderness and had grown up on manna and had grown up under Moses' leadership. And they were a very different people than the ones who had come out. They were their children and grandchildren, but socially and everything else, they were very different. And so they came in, and we see in the book of Joshua at the end, and the people, the children of Israel served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders that outlived Joshua. They were faithful. It was a faithful generation who had seen all the great things that God had done. Israel was to be, if you go back and read the law in Deuteronomy especially, and in Exodus, they were to be a kingdom of priests. Israel was to be God's light to the world. Because all the rest of the nations of the world, for the most part, just occasional little pockets, vestiges here and there of the truth. But the rest of the world was pagan. They were worshiping gods of brick and stone and wood and silver and bronze. And here we have a nation that is worshiping the true God. And under Solomon, they have a temple dedicated to the true God. And they are a powerful nation. And they are a nation that is faithfully worshiping the true God. And the nations of the world, the surrounding nations, came to Israel to learn knowledge. They came to Solomon to learn knowledge and to learn about Solomon's God. And the one time in all of Israel's history when they were actually doing what God had called them to do was this period of time we're going to be looking at. It was when Solomon was, it was set up by David. David started the process. But it wasn't until we get to the rule of Solomon that Israel was actually fulfilling their God-given purpose in the world. And, sadly enough, it was the only time that they fulfilled their God-given purpose in the world. Who did all this, ultimately? We can talk about the expertise of David, his great skill and so on. And yet we, as we're wrapping up the Psalms in Sunday school, the real issue, the reality of the matter is that God did it all. Time and time again, David is demonstrating his trust in the Lord. As you read through the book of 2 Samuel, there's a time and again also where it's talking about David's wars. David asked the Lord, what should I do? And God gives David battle plans. Says, do it this way, go this way, set up this thing, do it this way. Just as he did to Joshua under the conquest. God instructed David on how to win his wars, how to fight his wars. God is the one that gave David this empire, and with that empire, all the wealth. And with that empire, the peace and safety that went around it. And with that also, the fame that spread to the other nations all around them. God is the one that did that. What did God want? What did God use? God used a man who was willing to let God be king. Time and again, you'll see this in the Psalms, that David calls the Lord the king of Israel. Yes, I'm the guy wearing the crown. Yes, I'm the guy that sits on the throne. Yes, I'm the guy that lives in the palace. But the reality is, and I will speak it from the mountaintops, and I will declare it, and I will sing it, And I will teach that to Israel, that God is the King of Israel. And all that we see all around us, and all that has been accomplished, and all the wealth, and all the power, and all the prosperity that we experience is ultimately rooted in God, and this is what God has done. And David declared that. He was not going to take any credit for himself. This is all of all what God has done. And Solomon inherited that, and he lived it out for the most part. The first half to two-thirds of his reign, maybe in three-quarters of his reign, he did that. And they maintained, for the most part, the peace. He expanded the empire a little bit in the north. The riches and prosperity increased during that time. By today, if you look at all the stuff that he accumulated, all the and it talks about the wealth that was there, and it gives the weight of silver and gold and so on. By today's standards, Solomon probably was a multi-trillionaire. We don't have any of those today, at least not yet. A multi-trillionaire. And he's an absolute monarch. What limits Solomon as far as what he can do? Time, expertise, and resources. You know, we don't have the internal combustion engine. We can't do that. It's just not possible. But as far as what you could do physically, he could do. Israel was a light to the world. And the Queen of Sheba, and I don't have this on the map, where is Sheba? How far did this lady come with her great entourage to come and see Solomon? Sheba is modern Yemen. You know where Yemen is? It's the bottom of the Arabian Peninsula. Okay, Arabian Peninsula is this big, let me do it from here, is this big block. You've got the Red Sea south of Israel. On the other side, you got the Persian Gulf, and then you've got the Indian Ocean. That bottom corner is Sheba. And she came all that distance on a camel to come and see Solomon, and brought him gifts because she had heard and she wanted to know. And she is the one that's pulled out and singled out as a representative, but it talks about others that came to Solomon to learn, to know, to hear his wisdom. And it isn't just mathematical complications and why does it rain here and not there. They want to know about his God. Israel fulfilling its purpose. And so that's the importance of the Queen of Sheba. Now, promises, real quick. I want you to go back to Genesis chapter 49. We've looked at this several times. Genesis chapter 49. We talked about the importance of blessing this morning, and Isaac's blessing on Jacob. Here we are, yes, on Jacob. And here we have Jacob's blessings on his 12 sons, although some of them don't quite turn out to be blessings because of the nature of his sons. We get to Judah, who was the fourth born out of the 12. Reuben, Simeon, and Levi were passed over for various things that they had done in their lives. And we get to number 4, we get to Judah. He says in verse 8, Judah, thou art he whom thy brethren shall praise. And by the way, the word Judah means praise. Thy hand shall be on the neck of thine enemies. Thy father's children, here's key, shall bow down before thee. The other brothers would bow down. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, thou art gone up. He stooped down, he couched as a lion, and as an old lion, who shall rouse him up? Here's the key thing, look at verse 10. The scepter. The scepter is what? The emblem of the king, of royalty. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet. In other words, the succession of generations. Until Shiloh come, and unto him shall the gathering of the people be. Shiloh has the idea of what does that mean, has been kicked around for a long time. It means basically him to whom it is due. Shiloh is a messianic term. Because when Shiloh comes, To him shall the gathering of the people be, and because Jesus is Shiloh, because he has risen from the dead, he will never die again. When he rules and reigns, he will rule and reign forever and ever. There is no succession after that. You'll have this succession until Shiloh comes. And unto him shall the gathering of the people be. And so we have a promise that the kings would come from Judah and they would be finalized there in Messiah. I want you to go to 1 Chronicles chapter 17. This is one of the two passages at length. There's actually some in the Psalms as well that deal with the idea of the Davidic covenant. 1 Chronicles chapter 17. David has vanquished his enemies. We have alluded to this a little bit. It says in verse 1, now it came to pass as David sat in his house, in his palace, that David said to Nathan the prophet, lo, I dwell in a house of cedars, but the ark of the covenant of the Lord remaineth under curtains. And Nathan said unto David, do all that is in thine heart, for God is with thee. And it came to pass the same night that the word of God came to Nathan, saying, go and tell David my servant, thus saith the Lord, thou shalt not build me a house to dwell in, for I have not dwelt in a house since the day that I brought up Israel unto this day, but have gone from tent to tent and from one tabernacle to another. Tabernacle is just simply another word for tent. Wheresoever I have walked with the children of Israel, spake I a word to any of the judges of Israel, whom I commanded to feed my people, saying, why have you not built me a house of cedar? Now therefore, thus shalt thou say unto my servant David, thus saith the Lord God of hosts, I took thee from the sheepcote, even from following the sheep, that thou shouldest be ruler over my people Israel. And I have been with thee whithersoever thou hast walked, and have cut off all thine enemies from before thee, and have made thee a name like unto the name of the great men that are in the earth. Also I will ordain a place for my people Israel, and will plant them that they shall dwell in their place, and shall be moved no more. Neither shall the children of wickedness waste them any more as at the beginning. And since the time that I commanded judges to be rulers over my people Israel, moreover, I will subdue all thine enemies. Furthermore, I will tell thee that God will build thee a house. And he's not talking about a tabernacle. He's not talking about a palace. He's talking about a legacy, a dynasty. And it shall come to pass when thy days be expired that thou must go to be with thy fathers, that I will raise up thy seed after thee, which shall be of thy sons, and I will establish his kingdom. And he shall build me a house, and I will establish his throne, here's the key thing, forever. Drop down to verse 14. I will settle him in mine house and in my kingdom forever, and his throne shall be established forevermore. As you read the books of 1 and 2 Kings, you see the succession of David's heirs who occupied the throne of David. And in 586, the last of them, Zedekiah, was captured and blinded and carried off captive to Babylon. And to this day, there has not been an heir to the throne of David sitting on the throne. But Jesus, Matthew chapter 1, is the heir to the throne of David. And he was crucified and buried, and he rose again the third day to die no more. And a promise that was given in the book of Luke to Mary, declaring that she would be the mother of Messiah, is that I will give him the throne of his father David. And so when Jesus returns, the things we've looked at here in Revelation chapter 19, 20, 21, 22, Jesus will forever occupy the throne of his father David. And without succession, because he is glorified, he will die no more. And so we have the promise that his dynasty would be established. We have the promise that one of his heirs, his immediate heir, would build the temple. And we have the promise that an heir would sit on the throne of David forever. We have in 1 Chronicles chapter 28 and verse 5, the promise that Solomon would be king. We have the two attempts that we've already talked about to usurp the throne by Absalom and Adonijah. And the fact that when Solomon comes to the throne, he is a young man, probably not more than 20 or at the very most 21 years of age. This is what he inherits. This is what he starts out with. And we will be looking at the next few weeks, seeing what Solomon did with the great things that God entrusted with him. All right? Any further questions or anything on bringing us up to where this starts? That's the long prelude. Yes, sir.
The reason why David could not build a temple because he made too many slaughters.
Yes, he said you've made great wars, you've shed a great deal of blood. And Solomon is going to be a man of peace, and so he's going to focus on peaceful enterprises, and it will be he'll have a few battles here and there, but for the most part, it's going to be, economics and building and writing, because most of Proverbs, two Psalms, the book of Ecclesiastes and the book of Song of Solomon are all written by Solomon. And it also talks about other things that he wrote that we don't have in existence today. Okay. Anything else? All right, let's close in prayer. Father, thank you. Father, it's all of you. You are the one that builds the house. You are the one that builds the country. You are the one that sets people upon the position of leadership and brings them down again. Father, you are the king. And you are the one that we are to worship, and you are the one that we are to thank and praise and recognize as the author of all that is. And Father, as we look at what you entrusted to a man who was great, a man who was more capable than any fallen human, and yet we will see his goodness and his failings. That even the best, even the greatest, even those that are entrusted with the most, when they step aside from you, will fail. Father, thank you for your grace and for your goodness. Thank you for the reminder that it's all of you. We pray for Christ's sake. Amen.